right, so guys, we're back on part two of two of maybe part two of three. We'll see. But with Spencer Beach again, and it was a really engaging conversation. I really enjoyed it last week, and I'm excited to hear more. So we kind of talked about Spencer's story as a brief overview in case you're somehow tuning in to just the second episode. Spencer was involved in an accident with a fire, basically a chemical fire, and was given a 5% chance to live, and has come through it with the support of loved ones and connections to his wife and family. He's come through it. He's now full-time in safety and public speaking about safety, rather, as well as public speaking about inspiration and things like that too. And is it Calgary, Alberta? Where's home for you, Spencer?
Oh, not Calgary. You didn't dare.
Edmonton. Edmonton, Alberta. And so we were kind of cut short last time, but we were talking about your relationship with your wife and how this journey with your self-discovery and your trauma and everything, how that also was paralleled with your relationship with your wife. I'd love to hear as much detail you can give about that.
So I've done a lot of mentoring of people who have been injured and just gone through life trauma. And what has occurred, what I've noticed is that it's twofold. It's very dynamic. First, the injured person needs a lot of support. And what ends up happening is quite often you're dealing with so much. I describe it like a balloon. You keep on filling up a balloon with your emotions and eventually it's gonna pop. You need to release those emotions. And unfortunately, when people release their emotions, what occurs is they release them and it's your loved ones that are in the room at the time. So they're the ones that feel that that natural release that has to occur. And a lot of support networks, which you need, they get to this point where they're like, I didn't ask to be dumped on day after day and week after week and month after month. And they're doing their best they can to support you. They're not perfect. They're going to say the wrong thing. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they won't know what to say. So, and they end up, it creates where then the injured person or the person dealing with the trauma, they release again. But what ends up happening and what I noticed with my own relationship is for those that are lucky enough to keep their support networks, what I found is I got better and I regained more and more of my life. Tina had more time to reflect on what happened, and that sunk her down deeper and deeper. To where we hit a point about 5 years into my story and we're lying in bed one night. And 5 years in, I'm just graduating from university. I was told I was never going to work again. I've got my first paycheck again. I'm through the vast majority of my surgeries. There's no chance of me dying anymore from my burns. I thought things were going good again. I put my best foot forward and I was regaining life. And we're lying in bed one night and she tapped me on the shoulder and I rolled over. I'm like, okay, what's up? And she's like, I want a divorce. And that was the night I found out she had depression and severe depression. And I wasn't ready for it. And so at first I did what any normal person would have done, I think. And that is, you're in disbelief and you're like, oh, we can get through this. And you start fighting for the relationship. What ended up happening though was I was fighting for something and not listening to it. So she was saying to me things like, I need time and I need space to work things out, figure things out. And looking back on it, hindsight, that's completely normal thing for anyone to need is time and space when you're trying to formulate what has occurred to your life and your family's life and everything else. But as a husband or a spouse, time and space literally means the family is being destroyed. That's what it means. Because how can you have a family if you're taking time from each other and space from each other? You just can't. But if you stop being a spouse or a partner and listen with anyone else's ears, like a friend's ears, a lawyer's ears, a doctor's ears, a psychologist's ears, anyone else's ears, time and space makes complete sense. And I always say this, like if you're out with your friend and your friend's dealing with something, he's like, I just need some time and space to figure it out. You like, totally makes sense. I'm 100% behind you, right? But when you're in that relationship, it feels like an attack. So we battled for about a month. We fought over the kids, the cars, the house, and the money. Excuse me. And then I finally got to this point where she meant more to me than a divorce. And she meant more to me than than fighting all the time, than money or a car. So I just got to this point where I'm like, I need to do better. Honestly, she gave me, when I look at what Tina did for me in the time when I was getting better, she gave me everything she had. And plus some, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better support network. And now it's her turn to need support. And I'm fighting for me. I'm not fighting for her. So I sat down and asked myself just simply one question. She was gone for the day with our daughter, Amber. And I sat around our glass kitchen table and I asked, what did Tina do for me when I needed it? And what I found is in the 5 years it took for me to get better, she didn't once put the pressure of a spouse on me. She didn't once say, hurry up and get better. You know, I'm tired of doing all the chores around the house. Hurry up and get back to work. I'm sick of living on workers' compensation. And hurry up and spend more time with your child. You know, I don't care if it hurts. I need time for me. She never once did those kind of pressures. Instead, she was always a very supportive person to where she was letting me heal in my time and challenging me to get better, but not challenging me to regain the role of a husband or of that nature until I was able to. And so I realized, I'm like, she doesn't need a husband right now. She doesn't need someone who's trying to keep a family together. She doesn't need someone who's going to be lording over her or questioning what she's doing or when she's doing. Like, what she needs is a friend. So I literally had to go back to my first role in a relationship, which was hard at first to, because you're so used to being in a marriage relationship, to go back to being a friend, but that's what she needed. So I left the house. That was then after I made that decision that, you know, she needs a friend and not a husband, and time and space made more sense to me. The next day I left and I didn't take anything with me, honestly, to a point where I went extreme and I tried to leave her even my things, which made no sense looking back at it now, but it was like, you know what? I don't want anything. I don't, all I want is for you to be happy. And so I left the house and I moved to a completely different town, which was about 45 minutes away. And I did that so she would know I wouldn't be driving by, you know, 10 times a day checking up on her, right? I wanted her a peace of mind that she was, you know, I trusted her and she was able to do, heal and live her life, right? And the money that was creating so many battles, I realized that we saved all this money for the rainy days. And right now for her, it's pouring. And I can't help it. It is like the clouds are over her head and it's raining. And so I made up a rule, and that was, instead of fighting over the money, that rule was, if Tina needs it, Tina gets it. If she was in any financial stress and she needed a signature on a document to release funds, whatever, you know, that's what the money's there for. So, and instead of using our child as a weapon, which we both were doing, you know, it, because one of us stepped back, it allowed our child to be a child again to both of us. And what I found is it took 2 years of being separated, but she, you know, and she worked through the things she needed to work through. And then we decided that being a family was the best outcome for us. So we did cancel the divorce and we got back together and we're still married to this day. We're 23 years, I think, married coming up. But it's the battle is, the reality of it is, if you think trauma is just isolated to the person that's going through the trauma, it's not. It leads out to all those relationships and all those support networks, and they all need to heal in their time and their way. And here's, I've given you a lot already to digest. Here's the biggest thing. I don't get to choose when she heals, and I don't get to choose how she heals. I only get to choose if I'm going to stand by her when she heals. And that is the choice of the support network. Is, are you going to stand by them or are you not?
So what did that, give us some like practical examples of like what that looked like during those 2 years. Like I'm curious, to be honest. My wife and I have never been separated. We've gone through some stuff, but you know, like how, what did that practice look like? You just kind of were like, okay, the money's all yours if you want it. You know, and how did that work with the kids as well? I know this is kind of really prying here, so feel free to pass on the question if it's too intimate. But
well, we did 1 week on and 1 week off, right, with our kid. And I, because of my motivation speaking, it's, I tend to be on the road a lot, so that would interfere. You know, I have, it's my week, but I got to be on the road. Well, I got to be on the road. I got to, you know, earn income, the income and pay for, I'm paying for two houses now because we're living in separate places here. And it's, so it was important, but we were very amicable. It was like, yeah, we were more, it wasn't like Monday to Friday is your time, this is my time and whatever. It was very, because we were just stopping fighting and starting to support again, it became more, we could communicate better and we'd work together better. Another thing that I did is, being part of going back to being a friend is I started taking her back on dates. And at first they weren't dates. They were, let's get together for breakfast so we can talk, you know, but when we talked, we'd go for breakfast and I wouldn't bring up anything. It was just like, let's just talk. So like, who cares about money or divorce or any of that? So let's just be friends again, right? And avoid that stuff. And I think the biggest key in there is, and the hardest thing was to not fight. And it's so easy to get upset or play in the games you play in your head, you know, on trust issues and whatnot. Is if you trust someone, and this is what I've learned, if you trust someone, trust them. And if you don't trust them, then why are you with them? Why do you want to be with them, right? Like, you can't say, I trust you, and then play games in your head all the time. Doesn't mean that the games won't be there, but you got to learn to shut those games up. And those are your weaknesses, not theirs, right? Those are your insecurities, not their failures. And you need to separate those things. So it was just like, let's go out and have breakfast and, you know, just be two people who care about each other again, you know? And over time, it slowly worked out to where we ended up renting out our house, and then she moved in with me, and then we got back together, you know. But there was, towards the end of this period, there were some deep questions that had to be asked and answered, you know, because I don't want to go through this again, you know. So I'm not getting back together because it feels right. I want to get back together because it is right. So, and we had to make sure that was the right course of action. So,
mm-hmm. Wow. So, and so I know you have two kids, but was one of them prior, like the one obviously that Tina was pregnant with while you got your accident, but then did you have your second child after you got back together?
It was towards the final period of getting back together that she became pregnant. So,
okay.
Yeah. So our oldest is just turning 18, graduating from high school. She is, I think, 0.7% away from graduating with distinction. So maybe she can get her mark up 0.7% and get that distinction mark. She's a very smart girl. She's knows four languages, read more books than me and Tina put together, complete introvert. So all the mistakes I made early on in life, she's never made any of them. She's never tried to touch drugs or alcohol. In fact, she had her graduation just last weekend and some friends over, and one of her friends had an alcoholic drink and the rest were like, nah, we don't care about it. It's interesting to see the dynamics of kids this day. Then my son is, he's turning 12 and he's an extreme extrovert. He's got a learning disability, so his eyes didn't function together properly. It's been corrected. It just took some therapy. And but because of that, he's below grade on reading. He's caught up his math and his science and all that. So it's just really the reading and writing is his challenge now. And he's a complete sports nut. So that kid can throw a ball better than most men. He plays in tournament golf already. He can drive a ball at 12 years old. He drives a ball well over 200 yards, and it's quite impressive what he can do with on the golf course. In fact, a lot of adults will just stop and watch him on the driving range just because he's got such a natural and clean swing. So, and he loves to ski. He loves hockey. He literally rides a skateboard, a bike, or a scooter to school every day because he's just the type of kid that needs to be on the move. So,
that's cool.
I'd like to take a short sponsor break to tell you about the company I founded, Bunky Life. What we're famous for are small log cabin kits called Bunkies. that can be easily built in a weekend without needing a permit or a second mortgage. I've also authored the book, Bunky Life, Extra Space. Ultimately, we're in the business of helping families create extra space for more meaningful connection. And you can find out more at bunkylife.com. To see if your family might be ready for the Bunky Life, take the free 5-minute quiz at bunkylife.com/quiz. That's bunkielife.com/quiz. And now back to the show.
So I guess, tell us about the public speaking and how that's evolved and where you're at with it now.
So public speaking was my passion. When my mindset started to change, I knew I wanted to make a difference in this world and take my story and reach as many people as I could, but I had no clue what it was going to look like or go, or even if it's possible. So what ended up happening was the Glenrose Hospital, where I spent 5 months in recovery, was their 40th anniversary. And the Glenrose is the largest freestanding hospital in North America, a rehabilitation hospital in North America. And over that year, their 40th anniversary, they're going from ward to ward and ward and highlighting a different ward every month. And they got to the unit I was on and they asked if I wanted to speak. So I wrote a 22 page speech, and I read it word for word and I off the paper, and I wore a white t-shirt that said from Mexico. It was somewhere in Mexico that my doctor at the hospital brought back for me. And I had tearaway pants because I couldn't wear jeans at that time. My hands wouldn't function with buttons. And at the end, I got a standing ovation, and that's when I knew I had a voice that people wanted to hear. So, but then where do you go with that? So I joined Toastmasters and worked on my speaking skills. You may notice I don't say a lot of ahs and ums, even right now. I'm just, speaking off the top of my head. But that's happy, yeah, fun. But then I started to go to university and take all my safety courses. And while I was taking them, I was networking with professionals. I asked a few safety people or professional speakers for help, and they all shot me down.
Really?
Which really upset me. It kind of changed a lot of my passion too, because in a better way, but because here's people that are aim for, reach for the top and aim for the stars, you can achieve. And then here's someone who's trying so hard and has all these limitations and being told he'll never work again. And you're literally holding me down. I'm that doesn't sound like you believe in your own messages. So I've done a lot of mentoring because of them. I refuse to be like that. When people are trying to rebuild their lives, I'm like, how can I help you? Even though it may impact my own business, I'm like, I don't care. Literally, I drive around Edmonton and I've spoken to less than 1% of the industry here in Edmonton. There's more than enough industry for all of us to be able to speak that and help drive the safety culture. As well, I speak to schools and whatnot. But then I started to apply to conferences. That is really the key that got me in the door. And I would just apply for an educational session at the conferences. And I didn't get paid, but I had an audience of 80 to 100 people of potential clients. And the very first conference I did, I ended up with 2 presentations out of it. And the first paid presentation I ever did, I quoted them $500. And when I was all done, they paid me $1,000. And I'm a very honest person. So I'm like, you overpaid me. And they're like, no, we didn't. We felt your prices were way worth way more than what you quoted. And then from there, it just really steamrolled into, they say a good speaker does about 20 presentations a year. Other than COVID, I average either about 100 to 120 presentations a year.
Yeah.
So I travel over North America. I have my work visa in the United States, and I've never looked back.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've always been, so my background is I was a professional musician, and I've always leaned more towards do more gigs. It feels like you're doing more good in the world, especially in your case, since you have such a positive message. The 20 gigs a year thing just sounds like this weird part-time thing that you're doing. If you're doing like I used to play sometimes 300 gigs a year, and just you're doing it, right? Whereas opposed to I do one a month. It just seems like even if they're really well paid, or even if you get paid the same, it doesn't feel like the same job or the same passion,
Yeah. Well, and also you have to really treat it as a job. This is, if you want to be full-time in speaking, you're not going to do that 20 presentations a year, unless you're Bill Clinton and you can charge $250,000 per session.
Yeah. I don't necessarily know all the political guys are getting paid for the speaking actually though. So yeah. Okay, cool. So I guess if you were to address, like, let's say, you know, the Meaningful Connection podcast audience, which is basically people with families and they love them, they want to connect better with them. What would you say to those people, I guess?
Well, let me tell you about my near-death experience, which I don't believe we touched on in detail on the last podcast. So when I was in the fire and, you know, I gave up, everything became really calm and peaceful. I don't like to draw a lot of attention on that, but it was such a surreal moment that I have actually put to die on my bucket list because I want to experience that again. Unfortunately, life keeps on throwing other things in the way. So it's always on the bottom of my list and it keeps getting pushed down further and further. But it is something I'm no longer afraid of, but I do understand the joys of life. And I really want to express I'm not advocating or condoning suicide. If there's some issues going on in your life and you're contemplating suicide, don't take this as a real experience of me as permission. Go and get help. And because there's so much to life worth living and so many people that care about you. But what happened in that moment is when everything became calm and peaceful, time literally stopped. And all I could do was think about my wife, Tina, and our unborn child. Prior to the fire, I was worried about the bills. My wife, Tina, just lost her job. She was laid off. And, you know, I'm now the sole income provider. We just bought a brand new house, our first house. So, you know, I have to, the mortgage was on me. The food was on me. Everything was on me in that case. Granted, she did have an income from being laid off. And then, you know, on top of it, I was supposed to plan my friend's bachelor party that night. I was number two on the crew. You know, I had a whole list of services that needed to be done the next day and the day after that. You know, it's not like my life after I've done this job, that's it. I have no more work pressures. And, you know, this job is a rush job. It's a new home industry and flooring is the last major trade. And if you miss the move-in dates, I'm sure you're familiar with this. There's huge penalties. There's problems if you miss those move-in dates because you have clients that have truckloads of furniture that are supposed to go into a house that's not ready for them, right? Like, and they're supposed to be living there and they can't. It's a big issue, right? That all these pressures compelling me to do this job. And now I'm dying. And I can honestly tell you that all that mattered to me was my wife and my unborn child. Honestly, nothing else mattered to me. It took me a long time to filter this through and understand what was going on in my mind. But the conclusions I have found is those were my last thoughts in this world. And if they were my last thoughts, they had to be my most important thoughts. And it turns out what was most important to me wasn't money, wasn't career, wasn't success. It wasn't popularity. It wasn't going to events. It wasn't a long weekend and what I had to do then. It wasn't chores around the house. The most important thing to me was simply the people I love and the people that love me. And I think I really enjoy knowing that because now I know what is truly important in my life. And so I don't let stupid little things get in my way. For instance, I saw a guy today on Twitter complaining about Jason Kenney, the Premier of Alberta, having a 53-year-old bottle of scotch. And he doesn't believe that has this bottle of scotch that has been there for years. I'm like, really? That's your political prowess is going to upset you that much over some guy having a bottle of scotch in his office? I'm like, you have no clue on where your happiness is. You know, it's like you're letting such meaningless things interfere with your joy and your purpose. So, and I just don't let those things, it's like, whatever, it's not the end of the world. You know, if the end of the world is when I get that phone call that maybe my daughter was in a car accident. That's important, you know. The end of the world is making sure my family is, and this is my saying, I have a lot of sayings, but this is this one. If at the end of the day, my family is happy, healthy, and safe, I had a pretty good day.
Yeah. That's so true. Yeah, I think it's the part of the paradox of life is that you have to take care of business to ultimately come home to that hopefully happy, safe, and healthy family. And it's a mistake to think that life is about taking care of these things, as opposed to what taking care of those things ultimately allows you to do, which is spend time and connect with that hopefully happy, healthy, and safe family. And it's like taking your eyes off the ball. You know, the ball is that connection you have with the people that really love you and that you can love. And the other things are just the undergirding of the structure to make sure that isn't all. Make sure you don't lose your health. Make sure you don't lose your safety. Make sure, you know, yeah.
I call all that stuff the gravy.
The gravy.
Right? That's the gravy. You don't need gravy. You know, you need the meat and potatoes, right? The gravy is just there to make the meat and potatoes even better, right?
Yep. So. Well, Spencer, I don't know if I can top that. I mean, what a journey, what a story. I just want to commend you as someone who's been able to hear the story firsthand. It's like, good on you for turning something into good, and good on you for having the courage to share your story, especially like, it's not just the adversity of what you went through as the accident, but also just the adversity of, like, you know, the worker saying, you don't be a public speaker, that's not for you. Or even the other public speakers not friggin' throwing you a bone and helping out. Shame on you, public speakers. But I'm glad that it's all turned out. And, you know, if someone's interested in finding out more about you, maybe booking you for a speech or things, what's the best way to do so?
I just go through my website. It's spencerspeaks.ca. Or just Google my name, Spencer Beach. You'll find one of two things. You'll find me or a real beach in Hawaii. I've been to the real beach in Hawaii. It was a bucket list thing I had to do, but yeah, they're both pretty amazing. So
that's cool,
man. And then I do have a book. It's called In Case of Fire. So it details the first 8 years of the journey. It ends right when Tina and I are getting back together. And I had so many people asking, what happened? What happened? And I had to put a footnote into it saying, you know, yeah, we did get back together. But it's a journey of really friendship and love and support, you know, and there's just this fire part put in the middle of it that challenged it all, right? So, and then on top of it, my next goal in life, and I know this isn't really able to contact me, but is I started up a charity for burn research. And burn research is a very cool dynamic thing because they literally are trying ways to grow skin. And we're growing tissue. And in that, where the disciplines of it can go to, like, children who are born with defects or cancer patients or people involved in car accidents or whatever the case, the reach of this can go very far. But it's really, obviously, when you look at someone like me, there's a lot of challenges some people face with the scars and the deformities. And for me, I think I'm a very hot man, but not everybody has that outlook on life. Yes. So I'm trying to make the next person's journey a little bit easier. And so this is going to be our second year of running this burn research. It's over Burn Awareness Week in February 6th to 12th. We're starting just really small. We're in Alberta, but the goal is I want to inspire other burn survivors in different provinces and eventually in different states to represent their states and their provinces and to grow this to be much larger. And we're just, the whole focus is going to be really to children. We want to go to schools. And the reason being is we want to talk about burn awareness, but also about identity. Because these people who have these deformities and these scars and that, and giant smiles on their faces, you know, we know things about self-awareness that can definitely help young people in their journey of discovery of who they are. So.
Yeah. Well, that's inspiring as well. So how do you find more about the charity?
Well, right now it's just, COVID put us down for a year. So our second annual, we're just working out the details of it. Just stay tuned. Follow me on Twitter, follow me on Facebook, and LinkedIn.
Is it Spencer Beach, like B-E-A-C-H, or what's your Twitter handle?
Yeah, it's everything would be for all three of them, but just Spencer Beach, find them through that.
Cool.
I think Spencer one and variances of that, but, yeah, you'll find me that way. And I believe me, I'm the only one that looks like this. So I always consider myself as, like, if you can't remember me, you certainly weren't looking at me. So.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, Spencer, honestly, you're one of the good ones. Thank you so much for taking the time. And man, it's an inspiring story. I just want to give my wife a hug right now and my kids a hug right now. And thank you. Really, really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care, man.
Thanks, sir.
Okay. Cheers.
Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you've learned a lot, but beyond just mere intellectual entertainment, I hope it's changed the way you see relationships and inspired you to take action to make a connection with someone in your life today. Do it. I'd love to hear about it. And you can always email me directly at david@funkylife.com with the subject meaningful connection. Love to hear your stories.